Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I am Neda Ulibi. You can subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, actor Edward Norton on playing a cold and manipulative convict in his new movie, Stone. We've got a profile of this year's Nobel Literature Laureate, Mario Vargas Llosa. And our ongoing series, 50 Great Voices, shines the spotlight on a queen of country music. But first,
should you feel the urge to relive the 2008 economic meltdown, you can just head on down to your local cinema. There's the movie Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, a fictionalized version of the meltdown, and that's playing now. And opening today, a documentary called Inside Job.
Share prices continued to tumble.
Lehman Brothers was forced to declare itself bankrupt.
The largest single point drop.
Well, our critic Bob Mondello says movie fact turns out to be more engaging than movie fiction, at least in this case.
You can't be a film critic for long without falling in love with the efficiency of documentaries. It took a half hour for Oliver Stone's fictional characters to make audiences indignant about credit default swaps in Money Never Sleeps, but pretty much any 30 seconds in the documentary Inside Job will make you want to throttle the nearest banker, broker, or economic analyst.
Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, they knew what was happening.
What do you think about selling securities which your own people think are crap? Does that bother you?
Inside Job lays out the missteps of regulators, the greed of hedge fund managers, and the showboating of politicians so clearly, I couldn't help wishing it were opening in more than two theaters this weekend.
We had a whole group of people looking at this for whatever reason.
You can't be serious. If you would have looked, you would have found things.
What's striking about Inside Job is the company it's keeping at the multiplex, not just the education documentary Waiting for Superman and the war documentaries Restrepo and The Tillman Story, but also next week's unexpectedly riveting Gerrymandering, guaranteed to make patrons furious at the folks who draw the lines for voting districts.
Willie Brown recalls a gerrymandered district that was once proposed to help him win. At this point, the district was so narrow that it included only one lane and the center stripe of a San Francisco street.
Picasso would have been proud of the manner in which the lines had been...
Gerrymandering is an advocacy documentary, and its points are therefore arguable, I suppose. Panels that draw district lines might well bridle at the portrait it paints of their work, but having a point of view can make otherwise dry-sounding films awfully effective. An Inconvenient Truth, for instance, which jump-started a whole conversation about climate change. And documentaries are just one brand of fact-based feature. Audiences are currently puzzling out the truthiness of two Facebook flicks, The Social Network, a true story fictionalized that gets its facts mostly right, and Catfish, a true story not fictionalized in which you can't believe anything anyone says. There's also the faux documentary I'm Still Here, where actors play fictional versions of themselves.
Phoenix, Joaquin, Phoenix to see Diddy.
And biopics, where actors play real versions of people not themselves. The young John Lennon in Nowhere Boy.
I'm going to start a rock and roll group.
And the woman who owned history's greatest racehorse.
Secretariat is not afraid, and neither am I.
And then there's Howl, which takes a little bit from all those other forms to tell the 1950s story of beat poet Allen Ginsberg.
Would you say that Howl, the poem by Ginsberg, is obscene? Yes.
Howl employs actors, including a spellbinding James Franco as Ginsberg, to flesh out the poem and the court case surrounding it. It also uses animation to illustrate the poem.
Supernatural darkness of cold water flats, floating across the tops of cities, contemplating jazz.
Normally, you'd call Howl a biopic, not unlike Nowhere Boy or Secretariat. But Howl was made by documentarians, and apart from the poem itself, it takes its script almost exclusively from court and interview transcripts. You might call it an acted documentary, not docudrama, more a significant moment from a life recreated, a biomentary, maybe. Whatever, it's a trippy portrait of a time when poetry mattered enough that some people worried it could rend the fabric of a nation.
There are books that have the power to change men's minds.
The eternal war is here!
Let there be no running from non-existent destroyers of morals.
Oh, victory!
If Howl is scrupulous about getting its facts right, it doesn't pretend to be complete. Ginsberg's life was messy, and reflecting it too precisely would almost certainly result in messy filmmaking. Does that matter in a story about a real person? Well, I suppose that depends on where you stand. These days, billionaires like Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, who refused to cooperate with filmmakers, are likely to discover that filmmakers are perfectly comfortable making things up, and that the public that goes for scripted reality shows and nature films that use trained animals doesn't mind when they do. For patrons, as for filmmakers, a good story is a good story. Of course, the facts remain the facts, for those who care to know them. I'm Bob Mondello.
Musical Youth is a remake of the hit American movie High School Musical, adapted for a Chinese audience. The project is Hollywood's latest effort to break into the fastest-growing film market in the world, but as NPR's Louisa Lim reports, what made the film a huge success here appears to have been lost in translation.
Call it Romeo and Juliet for tweens or a winning money-making formula for the Disney Channel. High School Musical is on to its sequel number 4. It's been done on ice as video game, reality TV competition, and stage show touring Nigeria and Hong Kong. Argentina and Brazil did their own movie remakes. And this summer, China joined the party. China's High School Musical was touted as the first major Chinese remake by a Hollywood studio. Disney co-produced the film with two local partners. This allows it to bypass Beijing's quota system, which permits just 20 foreign films to be distributed in China every year. The music was written specially, rap elements were added, and a cameo by a famous Chinese comic. But the film flopped. I watched it alone in an empty Beijing cinema. The ticket seller said they couldn't remember having sold any other tickets to the show during its Beijing run. Strong domestic competition, bad timing, and poor distribution were factors. But film critic Zhang Xiaobei says cultural reasons are also to blame.
I think High School Musical wasn't very successful in China because it was overly Hollywoodized. As remakes become more popular, the problem of cultural differences will become more marked.
A case in point, China's High School Musical wasn't actually set in a high school. It had to be transplanted to a college. That's because Chinese high schools involve such a huge workload, there's no way students could possibly take part in the singing contest around which the film revolves. This movie may have bombed, but it's still at the forefront of what's likely to be a new trend. Independent producer Didi Nickerson says China's booming film market is increasingly attractive to Hollywood studios.
China was a small market, so only recently, as the theatrical market has improved rather dramatically, I mean, the box office has grown consistently. It was up 30-40% a year for 5 years preceding last year, up 60% last year, and looks to grow 60-80% this year. So it's a dramatic increase.
That growth means China's own film industry is struggling to keep up with demand. Put bluntly, there simply aren't enough good film scripts around. And remakes do make sense, as Nickerson points out.
The economics of making films here are terrific in terms of the cost. It's a good way for studios to brand build as well. So it actually is a good marketing strategy for studios. And if the film works, obviously there's economic benefits to it too.
What do women want? I know it has 3 syllables.
She herself is producing the next big-ticket remake. A Chinese version of What Women Want. The original starred Helen Hunt as a career-driven ad exec and Mel Gibson as her chauvinistic colleague who gains the gift of reading women's minds. The Chinese version features film star Gong Li and Hong Kong heartthrob Andy Lau.
I think the film has a different kind of depth than the original has because of what is going on here right now. And again, that you didn't have a lot of these issues 10, even 20 years ago because there wasn't this thriving commercial go-getter mentality that's really so pervasive in society today.
Well, you need a second day. You can't do it.
In a cramped Beijing apartment, director Chen Daming edits the Chinese What Women Want, which is due for release early next year. He says Chinese audiences tend to be negative about remakes, but with his star-studded cast, he's confident. His strategy to make the film more Chinese includes adding more father-son interaction, a virtual love affair, a satirical poke at ad agencies, and honing the gender roles.
What I want to do is make the female character stronger than the original film. China is a little bit different because of being a Chinese woman living in China is a bit of a harder than the States because you have to fight for everything. You look at the Olympics, who's winning all the gold medals? You know, our women, our Chinese women winning all the gold medals.
So what do Chinese women want? Love and power, says director Chen. And Chinese audiences, he says, want more emotion, less analysis. Chen himself trained as a child opera singer before writing and directing two films. This is his first big commercial film and his first remake. But he's already thinking ahead.
I would love to remake all the Hitchcock's films. Strangers on the Train, North by Northwest, that kind of movie I'd love to remake.
China's film industry may be relatively young, but its ambitious movie makers aren't afraid of dreaming big. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
The winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature was announced this week. Mario Vargas Llosa is one of the most acclaimed writers in the world. NPR's Netta Ulaby has a profile of the first Peruvian to win a Nobel Prize.
When he was a little boy, Vargas Llosa was told his father was dead. In fact, he had abandoned the family. And it shocked the child when he returned. In a 1988 interview with WHYY's Fresh Air, Vargas Llosa said the two did not get along.
My father, as many middle-class people in Latin America in the 50s, thought that to be a writer was to be an eccentric, as someone marginal.
Or even worse, effeminate. So Vargas Llosa was sent to military school. It was, he later said, a discovery of hell. But it provided grist for his first novel, published in 1962.
I think I'm sick, Lieutenant. I mean, mentally, not physically. I have nightmares every night.
A reading from that book, The Time of the Hero.
They're awful, Lieutenant. Sometimes I dream I'm a killer, and sometimes these animals with human faces are chasing me. I wake up sweating and shaking. It's horrible, Lieutenant. Honest.
The book was seen as an indictment of Peruvian society's acceptance of brutal military rule. Officers burned 1,000 copies in the school's courtyard. Since then, Vargas Llosa has produced mysteries, sweeping political epics, and earthy comedies. Like his friend, later enemy, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Peruvian moved to Europe, working in journalism and soaking up intellectual trends. Edith Grossman has translated both authors.
These men write in a large Baroque style. They have very long, complicated sentences. They experiment with punctuation, the structure of sentences.
Grossman has translated 5 of Vargas Llosa's novels.
The Feast of the Goat was harrowing to translate.
That novel, The Feast of the Goat from 2000, delves into the villainous regime of General Rafael Trujillo in the Dominican Republic.
It's a very powerful book. There were times when I had to stop working because scenes of torture were really heart-wrenching.
Mario Vargas Llosa's own political views shifted from the far left towards the liberal right. His free market views led to a run for Peru's presidency 20 years ago. But his opponents called his work obscene, as he told NPR soon after losing the election.
When I am asked about this, you know, I say, well, if that was true, I must say that 40% of Peruvians voted for obscenity and pornography, then.
Mario Vargas Llosa has written over 30 novels and plays. Language, he says, is a protagonist that helps him explore the vagaries of power, history, and human desire. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
In the new movie, Stone, actor Edward Norton plays the kind of guy you don't take home to meet mom and dad. He's a convicted arsonist doing time, but he's up for parole, which means he has to convince his parole officer, played by Robert De Niro, that he's a changed man. Norton's character, named Stone Creason, doesn't start out with much faith in the process.
You just setting them up so they can flop me, man. So you write what you're going to write, and let's just get on with it,
hey,
man, because I take the flop.
Stone.
Man, go ahead. Max,
son,
me.
Calm down.
Max me. You don't think I did? I see that Max standing on my
Stone.
Neck, man. I see you outside before you see me.
Stone!
That's the first time these two meet, and it's your first glimpse of Stone Creason, a disturbed and disturbing man. Edward Norton plays him with prison tattoos and cornrows and eyes so cold with malice it makes the hairs on your neck stand up. Edward Norton's come in to talk about the movie. Glad to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Let me just let listeners in a little bit on what happens in the plot so they can follow
yeah.
this. Stone Creason, the character you're playing, he is a manipulative character, and
yes.
he uses his wife, played by the stunning Mila Jovovich, to seduce his parole officer so that he can then try to blackmail him. Is that the idea?
Yes, yeah. and he's so anxious about the review process and about his upcoming parole opportunity that his wife, who loves him very much and is willing to do almost anything, he literally sends her at De Niro's character to seduce him. And I think that's where the film starts to become interesting, because even as he is scrambling to do whatever he thinks he needs to do and say, the interactions between the three of them start becoming increasingly complicated, because what seems like it's at first just a plot starts to become, in everybody's case, sort of an authentic inverting of their positions in the conversation.
I want to play, we have a bit of the movie that gets at the tension between your character, the convicted felon, and the seeming nice guy, the law-abiding, church-going parole officer. This is a bit where Stone is talking to De Niro's parole officer, and he's getting fed up with trying to prove that he has, in fact, reformed.
I think I deserve to be free. I do.
Why, because you did the time? That's it? You ready? And now you're a clean slate?
I'm clean as anybody, man. I'm clean as you.
maybe not.
Seriously, let me ask you something, you know? Why you get to sit there like asking me these questions like you never done nothing? I mean, why you get to walk around free and I don't?
I wasn't convicted of a crime.
Oh, you never did anything bad. Never did anybody no wrong. Had to be forgiven for nothing.
I never broke the law.
What, you never got a speeding ticket? You never backed somebody up in a bar fight in Vietnam? You never killed some kid? No, come on, man. Come on. How long you get to keep judging a person for one bad thing they done?
You've worked with a lot of amazing actors in your career. I know this is not your first time working with Robert De Niro, but is there a tiny piece of you that still, when you wake up in the morning working on a film like this, just gets goosebumps thinking, I get to walk on the set today and go head-to-head with Robert De Niro?
I think, I have a really deep appreciation for him as an actor, and I think for me the thrill or the appeal was, as we sat down to talk about this and I began to realize that he was really invested in this, that he was going to dig in really deep and go at it, I got a blooming sense of excitement, because I knew it was going to be an opportunity, a very rare opportunity, to really, you know, play out these scenes that, you know, in which you're trying to create dramatic tension out of nothing more than two people talking.
Well, and what's the process? A lot of the movie is scenes of just tightly shot, the two of you talking back and forth over a desk. How much rehearsal are you doing? How much do you talk about it before you go in and the cameras start rolling?
For a variety of reasons, we did a lot of talking in the months beforehand, just a lot of dissection of the script. It's very allegorical in some ways. There's a lot of deep undercurrents in it, and so I think De Niro and I both wanted to sort of go away on our own and investigate the specifics of these characters. So then we weren't together for quite a while, and then really we didn't rehearse the scenes per se. De Niro really didn't want to see me. He didn't want to see this guy or hear his voice. He didn't want to hear any of it until we sat down
oh, really?
In the chair and started rolling. So actually the first scene, the first day, John set the cameras up.
John Curran, the director.
Yeah. And he rolled, and I came in and sat down, and we started, and it was great.
What made it tough to nail down the way that your character was going to talk in this film?
He was vague in the script to me. It was originally set in the South, and John wanted to set the film in Detroit very specifically. He had this notion of Detroit as a great landscape of a place that was a pillar of assumptions about America, and that is now in decay in many ways. And you know, I went into a prison north of Detroit and started interviewing guys who were from Southwest Detroit or East Side Detroit, who came out of the gang culture or who had been involved in the drug trade. And once we pinned down a few guys that we thought really had a lot to offer, we asked them to read the whole script. And it was very, I have to admit, I found it very poignant. Like, these guys, I don't think have a lot of people talk to them about their own personal experiences in life. I don't think people express a lot of interest in them. I don't think in the routine of their day, they don't get asked to do much that's creative, to be honest.
To provide input on a big Hollywood movie.
And they came back. They both came back the next day. They had not only read the script overnight, they had written reams and reams of notes and thoughts. And it was really quite an experience. And John and I jettisoned 60% of the specific dialogue that was in the script, because what these guys brought back was so good in terms of the phrases and the vernacular and their insights into, oh, you'd never say this, you would say this, or telling us stories about, actually the clip you played where Stone kind of blows up and threatens to leave the room came out of one of these guys telling us that he had self-destructed in a parole interview and tried to walk out of the room.
Walk me through, Edward Norton, what makes you take a role? I guess I'm trying to see what the line is that gets you to Stone. In the past few years, you've done a couple of costume period dramas. Mm-hmm. You've done The Incredible Hulk. Square that for me.
Well, the great thing about films is how plastic they are. They encompass so many different kinds of stories and ideas. And I can be drawn into doing something just for the experience of making a different kind of film than I've made before. I mean, a film with a lot of digital effects was a very different experience for me. I learned a lot.
As an actor.
Yeah, no, yeah. I learned a lot about making films. But I guess if there's a deeper thread of interest that connects through some of the things I've done, it's that if I read it and I feel like I recognize things that it's talking about in me and my friends around me, if I read it and feel like it's naming things that I've experienced but never had a name for, that's appealing to me, because I think the experience of films like that can be special for people, because they're not always the ones that are entertaining, they're not always ones that are commercial, but they're the ones that kind of linger in your brain and make you realize like that something about the way we were living got caught in it.
That's the actor Edward Norton. His latest movie is called Stone. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
NPR's 50 Great Voices is a year-long celebration of singers, and this morning we celebrate the great Kitty Wells, the queen of country music.
Please release me, let me go.
Kitty Wells is 91 now. Starting in the 1950s, she recorded hit after hit at a time when women didn't have hits in country music. When she performed, Kitty Wells just stood on the stage and delivered the goods, with a country twang and a supple, powerful voice that reached right to the back of the house.
I just liked to sing, and I knew I had to sing with all my heart, you know, to make it sound right and to make the song go. So you know what you got to do when you're singing, so you get out there and do it.
I've been searching. I've spent a lifetime, darling, searching.
We talked about Kitty Wells with Robert Orman and Mary Buffwack, who wrote Finding Her Voice, The Saga of Women in Country Music.
What I love about Kitty's voice is the sort of pent-up intensity in it. It's like she's very private and very intense, but at the same time very penetrating.
Making believe that you still love me, it's leaving me alone and so blue.
Was it her voice that made her into a big star when women were not big stars in country music?
I think her voice was a great part of it, but I don't think you could separate her voice from the content. This post-war era is when a lot of Southerners are moving around. They're nostalgic for some of the roots of home. So she carried the tradition of the South with her. At the same time, the content's very updated to the current experience of people.
Society's fragmentation and society's dislocation and the problems of post-war life.
She'll ask me when I'm coming home. I'll answer pretty soon.
there have been females in country music from Chicago and from the West Coast and from Atlanta and other country music capitals, but Kitty came along when Nashville and the South were becoming the capital of country music, and there women were very much pushed to the background. They had all these weird rules that you couldn't play two female records back to back. Women couldn't headline concerts.
Kitty would also tell you that there weren't many songs being written for women at the time. More evidence that there was no encouragement for women to step forward and really be the stars.
I have found a new love, dear.
Maybe the most famous song she ever recorded was falls into the category of cheating songs, or as Kitty Wells, that's not what she called them, but can you explain what they are, cheating songs, and why they were so popular in the 50s?
After World War II, country music topics broadened considerably. Prior to the war, country was very much home and hearth and religion. After the war came drinking songs and what are called cheating songs, which are songs of adultery.
She recorded It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels as a response to a sort of a cheating song from a man.
Hank Thompson's hit. Kitty answers with It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels.
I didn't know God made honky tonk angels. I might have known you'd never make a wife.
He says in the song, I didn't know God made honky-tonk angels.
Right.
And her response is, God didn't.
Right, you did.
Too many times married men think they're still single. That has caused many a good girl.
The Opry was and is very conservative, and she was initially rejected by the Opry for not being showy enough, that she was too prim, and then she has this hit that's too outspoken, and then they ban her for that reason. It's like they tried to ban her both ways, both for being too conservative and for being too outspoken.
Another category of song that she sang it completely straight. Nothing dramatic, nothing weepy about it, but the songs were weepy and the audience cried.
There are just these tragedies that are oftentimes dealt with in song, and they're very, very moving. The loss of life, the loss of young children, death.
In one of Kitty Wells' famous songs, the loss of a wedding dress, not to mention.
Yes, right. I gave my wedding dress away.
Tomorrow was to be my wedding day, but I gave my wedding dress away.
When you listen to country music now, to women singing in country music, are there voices that just pop out at you and say, child of Kitty Wells, this is a Kitty Wells woman?
I would say Emmylou Harris, for one, because she did revive Make and Believe. Pam Tillis revived Amigo's Guitar. I mean, there are several women who draw on Kitty's repertoire.
And there are women that really are very much ingrained in that kind of country tradition that are really great, like Patti Loveless, Leanne Womack. These are not slackers in the vocal category, but they do maintain a much more regional sense to their vocals and their music.
Any Southern female country singer is going to be influenced. I mean, there's just no question about that.
Robert Orman and Mary Buffwack joined us from Nashville to talk about Kitty Wells, the queen of country music and one of NPR's 50 Great Voices. Their book about women in country music is called Finding Her Voice.
Making Believe.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's Arts Channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.